Today we are looking at Exodus chapter 2, and we'll also be tying it into a passage in Acts chapter 7 and another passage in Hebrews chapter 11. So we're going to ask you to take your Bibles, and if you would, just turn to Exodus chapter 2. As we read about the life of Moses, because the baby Moses opened his eyes on an unfriendly world. He was born to the most powerful nation on earth, but he was foreign, oppressed, and at a time when all the babies, including himself, were under a royal death sentence. Now, everyone loves stories about babies, right? Have you ever seen an ugly baby?
Yes.
By the way, I think every baby, you know, they're little, shriveled, red, crying, pooping, don't even know their dad or mom. You know, they're just a whine. Oh, no teeth, no hair usually. It's just sad. Reminds me of the way I'm going to be in a short time. But anyway, chapter 2 reads like a fairy tale. You know, Moses is born into this place where he's supposed to be killed. What's going to happen? Mean Pharaoh is coming. And what do we say? Da, da, da. You know, right? We have our little... And then, oh, he escapes, and on. And you realize that in the 22 verses that we'll look at today, we see the entire life of Moses from verse 1 to verse 22, 80 years encapsulated in just a few verses. It begins with this miracle baby and ends with an 80-year-old codger out in the desert with a bunch of sheep. And you say, boy, that's not much of a plot line, is it? That doesn't bode well. But it's wonderful how it explains what God is doing. We associate Moses with water, right? They cross the Red Sea that splits apart. They need water to drink. He hits a rock. The Nile River, the greatest river source of the Western civilization, turns to blood. I mean, we think about that. So today, I thought that we would look at his early life history, and we'd see it in 4 points that all have to do with water. Easy for us to remember, because Moses is in the water, he's out of the water, he's in hot water, and then he's drawing water at the well. And, you know, that pretty much summarizes his life. And since I'm a preacher that's often accused of being all wet, I thought that would make a good, simple outline for us to look at today. The first thing we see in Exodus 2, verse 1, is Moses in the water. Now, a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived, bore a son, and when she saw that he was, in some texts they're going to say a beautiful baby, others are going to say a goodly baby, an excellent, and over, what would we say, above average. Like Wobegon babies, the above average baby, she hid him for 3 months. Now the family, as we know from Exodus chapter 6, mom and dad do have names, Jochebed and Amram, both Levites. And by the way, in Sunday school when we were at the Baptist church as a boy, I heard all kinds of stories about the baby Moses in the basket, in the bulrushes. You know, I love that story. I went to the Jewish Talmud Torah school and heard that Moses was born almost miraculously, because to the Jews, Moses is higher than Abraham. Moses is the great Old Testament figure. They said that his mother delivered him without any pain in her delivery, that he was so beautiful that when he was born, the entire room flooded with light, that he was walking and talking at 1 day old and never needed his mother to nurse him, just to feed him solid food, because he was this miraculous Moses. Well, then I realized and thought to myself, maybe all these stories are just kind of fairy tales here about Moses and this basket case that he was down at the river. I wasn't sure. We know that he had an older half-sister, Miriam, 6 years old. He had an older half-brother, Aaron, 3 years old. And then here is Moses. that is born. But as parents were believing parents, they followed God, not man. The natural parental instinct is not to obey the government when the government says you have to kill your baby. You know, what kind of a monster would kill a baby? He asks rhetorically, but we all know what kind of monsters they are. His parents refused to put him to death. They thought he was good. They thought that he was a child from God. And they weren't about to throw him into the river any more than today a Christian would, in our sophisticated style, would vacuum the baby out of the uterus rather than throw him in the river. Great faith that they had to do something with this good baby. When I was reading this, I thought, immediately I started humming, "You must have been a beautiful baby." You all know that song back from the war years? Okay, some of you are old enough. You know, too good to be thrown to the crocodiles. If he was an ugly baby, we'd throw him their crocodile food in the river. But he was a good baby. By the way, that word good is a good word. It's used in Genesis 1 and 2 when God created the world. What did he do? Everything that he did, he saw that it was good. Same word. And this is a God-created child. And they looked at that baby and said, "We cannot kill it. We're going to hide it. We're going to do what we have to save its life." For 3 months, they did that. And that is what is commended in Stephen's sermon in Acts chapter 7, and then the writer of Hebrews in Hebrews 11. In verse 20 of Acts 7, Stephen said in his sermon, at the time Moses was born, he was good in God's sight. That helps us understand that word good. And he was nurtured for 3 months in his father's house. Hebrews 11:23, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents. For they saw the child was, and this is another translation, extraordinary. That he was a gift from God, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. So the praise goes to the parents, not for the cute little basket floating in the Nile. The praise and the commendation goes to them in these desperate times of saving and hiding the baby and not allowing him to be killed. But desperate times call for desperate measures. And the story continues in the first part of verse 3. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a papyrus basket and sealed it with bitumen or tar and pitch. Finally reaching an age where this little tiny squeaky newborn cry was turning into the cry of a three-month-old. You can't hide that you got a baby. Anyone that knows you have a baby knows that it has to be killed. It was the government law. And so their faith that is so commended for hiding the baby is not mentioned at all about putting him in a basket. Their faith is here where they realized they couldn't do anymore. They would have to turn it over to the miracle-working God. And so she waterproofed the basket, made literally a boat. The word basket it's used here is the same word for Noah's Ark. Okay, only instead of made of gopher wood, it's made of papyrus. Papyrus plants can grow 9 feet in the shallow waters, 9 feet tall, taken, dried, woven together into this beautiful basket, covered inside and out with tar and waterproofed, put the baby in it, and trust God, because there's nothing more they could do. There was no more that they could do. And by the way, Isaiah 18, I give you the reference, is a verse about the people of the Nile that were floating on the the river of Egypt in the Nile on boats made of papyrus, full-size boats. So this basket is just a kind of a miniature ark, a miniature boat that you have. So we see the resistance to the law, desperate times, desperate measures, and then the reliance on God because they had a desperate plan. Verse 3 continues, she put the child in that ark, placed it among the reeds by the river bank. Moses' mother did exactly what Pharaoh's law demanded. Put your baby in the river. And that she did it in a life jacket, so to speak, or in a little basket to float on, that's just creative law keeping there. I think she really just feigned obedience to Pharaoh's law as she did this, faith and trusting for the child's welfare and the future to be to God alone, giving up something precious to her. My wife and I were talking about this passage. She gets to hear my message about 5 times every week before I get here to preach. And she said, how could you do that to a 3-month-old? By then, wouldn't you be so bonded to that baby? How could you do that? Now, if it was 13, sure, throw them in the river, sink or swim, but 3 months? No, you can't do that. But she had a desperate hope. No idea what was going to happen. And so in verse 4, she placed his sister, Miriam, at a distance, watching what would happen. She strategically floated him in the river, close to shore, big tall reeds, not able to see it very well, covered from the hot sun with the shade of the reeds there. Not on a sandbar, not on a beach area where the crocodiles come to feed and warm up in the sun. And then tells her 6-year-old daughter, watch and see what happens and then report to me. What 6-year-old daughter isn't going to love that new baby like it's her own? That isn't just going to be playing dolls with little baby Moshe all the time there and then is able to say, okay, I've got a special role I can play. And she sat, probably strategically hidden, and watched. Well, Mom, I can only imagine, went off quietly and cried. Trusting the providence of God, not knowing what would happen. And what would happen? What would be the worst thing that could happen to that baby? They got them protected from the sun, protected from the crocodiles in a nice place like that. They're hoping that some Egyptian woman who's doing laundry there at the riverside is going to see this baby and save it. But what happens? Da, da, da. Okay, we've got our cliffhanger here. Because the least wanted person shows up and takes Moses' second point out of the water, beginning in verse 5. Now the daughter of Pharaoh, this is the Pharaoh who said, kill all the baby boys of the Jews, no exceptions, came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the water. She saw the basket among the reeds, sent her servant woman, and then she took it. She'd come down to bathe. This was a typical practice. Now, the princess is royalty, so she's got her own little entourage of ladies-in-waiting who are walking with her. I wondered why they were standing alongside the river while she went in to wash. And I thought, I know why. They were there to watch for paparazzi. They were there to watch for those photographers that would be trying to get some picture of the princess. Well, they were probably watching for crocodiles, seriously. They were probably watching for, keep any crowd away in reality. So her bodyguards were there, and she's in the water, and so she gets to view now this basket that couldn't be seen from shore, and looks out there and says to one of her servant gals, go and find it. That's not flotsam and jetsam. That's not just trash that came down the flooded Nile Valley. This is something nice. Don't open it, but just bring it to me. And so she, I think, first of all, shows sovereign care, sovereign viewing or sighting, as she miraculously, I think, finds this basket. And then verse 6 says that when she opened it, she saw the baby. And behold, the baby was crying. And she took pity on him and said, "Aw." I think "aw" is implied in the original. "Aw, this is one of the Hebrew babies." By God's guidance, Pharaoh's daughter had found the little baby Moses. Conditioned by her culture and the law of the land was to kill. It's a Hebrew boy. Somebody said, "Well, how could you tell it's a Hebrew boy?" Well, you can tell it's a boy, and then because it's a Jewish boy, it would be circumcised, unlike the Egyptian boys. And so right away, it didn't take rocket science there. It's like the little boy that went to with his father to see the new kittens that were born at the neighbor's house. And they walked in there, and he could hardly wait to get home. And he said, "Oh, Mama," he said, I saw the most beautiful kittens. There was a little boy kitten and a little girl kitten." And Mama looked at the three-year-old and said, "How do you know?" And he said, Dad said it. It must be written on the bottom or something, but I can't read yet." Oh, and I thought, here this sweet princess with no children of her own finds this little baby, and the cry melted her heart. She took pity on it. Pharaoh could pass all the laws that he wanted to. He was old. He was literally at this point on his deathbed. He'd be dead within the year, the Pharaoh. But his own daughter defied the law. She defied the death sentence that would come on someone who didn't kill the baby. She said, "I don't care. I'm going to do what's right." Not because she knew God, but because she simply took pity on human life. Because there are needs that are, I call them the needs of humanity. It isn't because we're a Christian. It isn't because we're better or worse than anyone else. It's just that we're a human being. And if you see another human being in need, you help them. You don't kill them. You work with them and you try to provide. And so God had planned the deliverance of the baby Moses, who would then plan the deliverance of the people of Israel 80 years later, but skillfully guided this woman in her pity to defy the law of the land. And Pharaoh had to stop. We're told in history that Pharaoh's command to kill all the babies had to stop right there, because his own daughter would be executed because she took this baby and didn't kill it. And so we see a great change taking place because of this. I like to think that it's really neat when a plan works out. We have a lot of plans. We're making plans for a couple of trips. And you know how it is, you work on plane fares, you work on getting a rental car, you get on hotels, and you got to make sure everything dovetails together. It's a mess. And then a blizzard comes or whatever. Well, that's going to be in July, so I hope no blizzard is there yet. But, we're planning out to go to California, all these things. And I'll be honest with you, till we get there and get the car and get from the airport checked into the motel, my wife will be the first to tell you, I'm a nervous wreck. I am nervous Nelly. I am frustrated. I'm irritated with everything in the world, and except the one goal that I have before getting to that hotel, which is, of course, getting to Krispy Kreme and getting a donut. But then get to that hotel and get settled in. Then, for the next week, everything is just perfect with the grandkids, just having fun, doing good things like that. And then We have to get back to the airport, turn the car in, get checked in, get through security, get to the airline, see if our flights have been canceled, back to Casper. And the nerves are all there. And then somebody said, "Do you have a relaxing vacation?" Yes and no. But a plan's worked together here. You just say, "Boy, this is really a neat story that God took care of it." Well, it's not quite done yet. Not only do we see the rescue, we see the redemption, the sovereign care here. Because in verses 7 through 9, his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Should I go and call a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." The girl left and called for her mom. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take the child away, and I'll pay you to nurse him for me." And so she took the child and nursed him. The plan just happened to find a mother, just happened to find someone who had trusted God, and now God was rewarding her faith. I was reading a little biography of Susanna Wesley. 19 children. Two of them died shortly after being born, but 17 lived. Number 15 was John Wesley, great preacher. The youngest baby, youngest son, was Charles Wesley, who wrote 8,000 of our hymns. And she's just a godly woman who wanted to raise her children godly. She said the first thing she did was teach them to cry softly. She said, I love the line, I should have gotten it for one of our quotations in the bulletin. She said that you can't discipline without a stick. Other than that, it's just training animals. So she said that at age one, she taught them with the rod as well as with her sweet voice. Raised wonderful children. And I can imagine this mother doing the same thing. And now she gets to spoil the Egyptian princess, take her wealth, because she's going to be paid. No need to fear anymore. She can walk around with perhaps a royal blanket on, so everyone knows this is her baby, but or that she is nursing for the princess, but he's really an Egyptian prince. How long? We're not told in Scripture, but the minimum was usually age 5, and sometimes all the way to age 9, 10, or 11, that they would nurse the child, then they would teach them proper manners and actions, and then turn him over to the Egyptian princess. So for years she has the opportunity. Moses says in chapter 3, verse 15, that he learned the God of his fathers. How did he learn that? He didn't learn that in Egypt. He learned that from his mother. Down in verse 11, a few verses ahead of us here, he knew that the Jews were his countrymen. How did he know that? He was years being trained by his mother. He learned the Hebrew. He learned the culture. He learned about the covenant that God had made with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and so forth. She knew the day would come but when she would have to give him up, but for years, she was able to keep him and train him and teach him. I love that. What a great blessing. And then God's hand in the adoption took place here as well. Verse 10, when the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She, that is Pharaoh's daughter, named him Moses because, she said, I drew him out of the water. Now, I don't know what Jochebed called him for 5 or 10 years. She might have called him Bamim, which is in the water, because that's where she put him. But the name Moses is a nickname. It's a Jewish word that means drawn from water, the word of the slaves that was taken. It was also the Egyptian word for son. The name of the princess's grandfather who started the 18th dynasty was Ahmoses, 1570 to 1546. Her father was Amenhotep I, And he was the one that was on the deathbed at this time. And then her brother, T-U-T-H, Moses. There's an H sound in there, Moses. He took over in 1524 and was the Pharaoh when Moses was adopted then and brought into the palace with her brother. And don't get them confused. I'm throwing out Egyptian pharaohs. You're all saying, thank you a lot. This is really spiritual. But Amenhotep II is going to come along in the 1450s, and he's the pharaoh that's there when the Exodus happens, when Moses, as an 80-year-old, is in confronting him. And then you all remember his great-grandson, Tutankhamun. Again, all in that 18th dynasty of the Egyptians, King Tut, that we have there. But you see, there's a lesson here. God is able, according to Ephesians 3:20, to do immeasurably more than we can ask or even imagine, according to the power that works within us. To him be the glory. Don't think that we can pray and say, God, you need to take care of this, and then worry and fuss and not be sure what God is going to do. God knows. God watches. God cares. And if he watches over a little baby in a makeshift little ark floating in the weeds of a river, don't you think that God is able to answer our prayers and do more than we could even imagine? I mean, that the boy would be saved would be a great answer to prayer for Jochebed. Just, Lord, let him find some Egyptian family that'll take him in and raise him as their own. No, he's a prince. He is next in line to the Pharaoh. He is a royal, as it were. And so her son is spared, protected, kept, and the policy of genocide is stopped. And the Jews, well, we've already learned, they just continue to multiply. They continue to have babies and babies and babies, and soon are going to outnumber the Egyptian population. According to Josephus, the historian, Moses was not just the heir of the throne of Egypt, but that he was a great general who led the Egyptian army against the Ethiopians. That's down below our map down here in Ethiopia. And won great victory there. And treated as royalty, where everyone had to bow to him as he came by. Acts 7, again, I've asked you to kind of keep both passages here. Acts 7:22. Stephen in his sermon said, Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. He learned geography and history, and grammar and writing and literature and philosophy and music and all the things that he's going to have to forget when God says, oh, we've got a change in plans for you here. Because Moses isn't just in the water and out of the water. We see Moses in hot water. Verse 11 in our story continues. On a day when Moses had grown up, and by the way, Acts 7:23 says, when he was 40 years old. So we just moved from 1525 down to 1485, that he is now 40 years of age. His heart was moved to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. On the day when Moses had grown, back in Exodus 2, verse 11, he went out to his people. He watched their burdens. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked every direction except up and saw no one. So he struck down the Egyptian and then buried him in the sand. 30 years or more have now passed, and Moses, an adult, trained, leader, warrior. We're not told how he killed. Somebody said, did he use a sword and cut off his head? Did he run him through with a spear? Did he just punch him and knock him down? And does that really matter? No. Moses killed the guy, premeditated, hated what he was doing, said, I'm going to he was moved by what he saw outside the palace walls. You see, when it says that, he saw what was happening there, the word is not just to see, but it's to see with feeling. It's used in Genesis 9, where God saw the created world after the flood, and he was moved with his emotion. It was a scene with feeling. In Genesis 21, he was in distress as God saw the wickedness of the earth. And so it's not just a general word like, oh yeah, I saw him doing that. No, he was involved. He was motivated. He saw this and he identified with the children of Israel. He went out to be with them. He'd made a crucial decision to identify with the Jews, willing to suffer with them. He'd given up his status by going out of the palace and seeing this happen. And a whole new generation had grown up, worked as an adult life, and now 40 years have passed. This is a whole new generation between Moses being born and this event. And most of them were now getting older. Slavery was hard for them, and they were dying. Moses identified with them. In Hebrews 11, verses 24 to 26, the writer of Hebrews says, "By faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking at the final reward." Lots of truth, lots of application for us in that verse, even as the writer of Hebrews said. He had sympathy towards his people, the Jewish people. He couldn't stand by and watch. Now, am I making an excuse for what he did? No. Premeditated murder, that's not right. You say, well, it was kind of justified. No, it wasn't. There were methods that he could have done, but he was so out of control and angered as he was a Jew watching a Jew be beaten half to death that he defied the authority of Egypt and wanted to show the people that he was a leader, that he was the man they could count on. In Acts 7, as the sermon of Stephen continues, Acts 7, 24 and 25, it says, "Seeing one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. He supposed that his Israeli brothers would understand what God was giving them, deliverance by his hand, but they didn't understand." He wanted this to be his plan. He'd waited for 40 years to step out of being the prince of Egypt and into the deliverer of God's people. Well, they didn't understand because his leadership failed. Here, as we see in the second point, he went out the next day. Behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. He said to the man in the wrong, "Why did you hit your companion?" And he said, "Who made you a prince or a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me like you did that Egyptian?" Moses believed his education, his authority, his demeanor. He was the prince of Egypt. He was next to the Pharaoh in power. And the people didn't believe him. They didn't see him as a deliverer. They saw him as a criminal, as a murderer. Acts 7, 26 through 28, Stephen's account of this story. He said, "On the following day, he appeared to them as they were quarreling and tried to reconcile, saying, 'Men, you're brothers. Why do you wrong each other?' But the man who was wronging his neighbor thrust him aside, saying, 'Who made you a ruler or a judge over us? You want to kill us like you killed the Egyptian?'" You see, he was a prince. He had authority and right and expected the loyalty of the Jewish people. Didn't get it. He was a judge. He had life and death authority as second to Pharaoh. People said, "We don't want you to be our ruler. We don't want you to be our prince, our judge. Isn't that what the Jews said of Jesus when he came and offered them deliverance? And he says, we don't want this man to rule over us. We have no king but Caesar. It's the same in all generations. So, Moses was afraid, verse 14 continues, and thought, surely the thing is known. I've been found out. My plan for 40 years to step out of the shadow and be the leader, I'm in trouble. He saw himself as the protagonist, the leader of this new rebellion, to lead the children of Israel. And not only did he not have a following among the Egyptians, he didn't have a following among the Jews. Nobody wanted to follow him. I said, you can always tell a good leader by the type of people that follow him. And he had no one. And I'm sure he felt that God's plan for his life was now totally defeated. There was nothing more he could do. And I'm sure God in heaven was saying, now I've got him just where I want him. Now he's down to the humility level that he needs to do. Verse 15 concludes this part of the story. When Pharaoh heard it, he sought to kill Moses. This is his nephew. But Moses fled from Pharaoh, stayed in the land of Midian, and we see him there then sitting down by a well. That's where he ended up. He took off out of Egypt. He crossed the marshy lake area in the northern part of the Gulf of Suez. The Red Sea goes and splits at the top. He crossed over the desert in the Sinai wilderness. He crossed over to the land of Midian. Actually, Midian covered this whole region. And sat down by a well. And I'm sure he thought to himself, I'm done. That's it. 40 years wasted. And I thought to myself, yeah, 40 years of another generation living and dying, hoping for deliverance. But when the deliverer came, they didn't believe him. The final part of the story that we see in Exodus chapter 2, this 80-year history all condensed into 22 verses, we see Moses now drawing water. In verse 16, we continue with the judicious intervention of Moses in the problem that he found. The story says, now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, filled the troughs to water their father's flock. But after they'd done all the work, can you imagine? You get a well, you take the cover off of it, you draw it up with buckets, and you fill the trough for your flocks. They do all the water, get it all ready, and then the other shepherds come by and drive away the girls and their flock and use the water themselves. And the girls just have to wait and wait and wait and then draw water again and finally water their sheep. The priest had seven daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Verse 17, the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and delivered them. And then, amazingly enough, he watered their flock for them. Now, we're introduced to some more characters here, and we need to make sure we understand that the priest of Midian, he is a descendant of one of the sons of Abraham. You say, wait a minute, Abraham had Ishmael, the father of the Arab people, and Isaac, the father of the Jewish people. But after Sarah died, Abraham remarried. And his wife Keturah and him had six more children, including one named Midian. And his descendants worshiped the Lord. They were sons of Abraham. And Jethro, or Reuel, his title, was one of these descendants, generations later, that were worshiping the true God as best they knew how, out in the middle of the deserts of Midian. And he was giving sacrifices and prayers to God on behalf of the people. And all we know about him is he had seven daughters, and they were being bullied. And you know what we say about bullying, all of you public school kids. You know, you know, you can't, well, you know, you got to, no bullying. We don't allow that. But evidently it was an everyday occurrence. And Moses, can you imagine growing up being waited on as royalty hand and foot, now has traveled all this way across the desert, and he's sitting there thirsty, waiting for a drink, waiting for somebody to get the water for him, because that's what royalty does, just be served. He stopped and said, no, I'm going to defend these helpless people. He learned what it was to be a true servant. He learned to minister for others. And so the girls came home, and obviously it was early compared to when they normally get there after all the other watering was done. In verse 18, when they came home to their father, he said, how is it you've come home so soon today? And they said, well, an Egyptian, remember, that's what Moses was to them, the way he dressed, spoke, everything. An Egyptian rescued us out of the hand of the other shepherds. And then he drew water for us and watered the flock. I mean, this is a really nice guy. He's an Egyptian and even helped us. And I'm a woman and nobody helps women. They do all the work. Probably the shepherds recognized Moses as an Egyptian, and I'm sure that that might be why he delivered the girls. I'm sure he stood up and, you know, he's there in his royal robe yet, in his gear that make him look as this official. And they didn't want any conflict with Egypt, and they took off on the run. And he drew water then. And rather than, by the way, rather than killing the other shepherds, he just chased them off. He already was learning restraint. And he was learning about the providence of God. He just happened to be at that well at that time, and at when all these events took place. No. Moses, I'm sure, recognized this was not a chance encounter, but part of the leading of God, and he was submissive to it. Well, Jethro asked his daughter in verse 20, okay, where is this guy? Why have you left him? Call him so that we might come and eat bread. You know, Jethro wants, through kind of a gentle chastisement of his daughter, saying, this guy did all this for you, and then you just left him at the well? What kind of girls are you? And I'm sure the girls are talking to themselves saying, you know, this was really a good catch, and we let him get by. We let him get away. Zipporah, the oldest of the seven girls, I'm sure was being urged by her sister, saying, you know, he might make a good husband material. He's willing to draw water for you. You wouldn't have to be out tending the sheep. He'd do that for you. This is a pretty good deal. Now, the other six girls probably had a little less than altruistic motivation, because remember, until the oldest daughter marries, the other daughters can't marry. So they want to get the old lady out of there, get Zipporah out of there. And yeah, this is a 40-year-old. Yeah, he's a little older, but he's okay. And their dad is saying, come on, girls, what are you doing? You left him there. Our hospitality. Have him come in and eat bread with us. Don't let the good one get away. Just because you're prejudiced, because he looks like an Egyptian, just because he doesn't look like one of us, doesn't mean that he's not a good person. So the story concludes in verses 21 and 22. And Moses was content to dwell with the man. And he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. She gave birth to a son. Moses called his name Gershom, for he said, I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. Moses is ready to start the next stage of life, a new life. He gave up on Egypt, gave up on the hope of delivering the Jews. They didn't listen to him. They didn't want him to rule. And he was, you know, in real trouble. He had no chance to go back to Egypt because the Pharaoh had a death sentence out for him. Moses was content to be where he was at. And in Egypt, for 40 more years, 40 more years, another generation was born and died with the hope of someday being delivered, but it didn't come. Moses is out here in Midian becoming a shepherd, not the deliverer that he thought he would be. His new family, Zipporah, by the way, I love Zipporah, is the Hebrew word for Twitter. We all use that, right? If you tweet or twit or whatever you do, you Twitter things. It's a small bird. He was a refugee from Egypt, now with his new Semitic, non-Jewish family, a shepherd in the wasteland, and everybody would just assume he'd fade out of the picture graciously. That would be the end. He'd live out the next 40 years till he was 80 or so, and then he'd be gone. And when he had a baby boy, he named him Stranger, or Alien. That's the word Gershom in Hebrew, because he said, I've been a stranger. He said, I was a stranger in Egypt. Egypt, where he was born. Egypt, where he was raised in the palace. But that wasn't really his home, and he knew it. Midian wasn't really his home, and he knew it. He was looking for another place, a city that had spiritual foundations, a city of God. We make a mistake when we think of the years in Midian were a waiting time for Moses. He's going to spend 40 years there working, a working time. And remember, he'd never worked this hard in his spoiled life. He was in over his head. Someone said that he needed to be trained. He needed to be trained in the wisdom of Egypt. He needed to be trained how to lead sheep. He needed 40 years in Egypt. He needed 40 years on the backside of a desert so that he could lead the last 40 years, a bunch of recalcitrant Jews, through the wilderness and up to the promised land. 2 years in training for every 1 year that he served the Lord. He was there. In Egypt, he learned to be somebody. In Midian, he learned to be nobody. Just a shepherd, just out wandering. If the drought was too severe here, they could cross to the other side of the sea, and this was all still Midian-controlled wasteland, badlands. He could do it there. In this little brief bio of Moses, we conclude by saying we see the ebb and flow of life, that starting out right is the easy part. Continuing on when challenges come is the hard part. Moses' parents, for 3 months, they're commended. They hid the baby. They're going to save him. But then they put him in a basket and said, well, we'll take our chances. Moses, I'm going to go and deliver the Jews and trained and learned the history and learned everything. And then he runs for his life and he ends up out in the middle of nowhere. And by the way, if you ever want to know what this land looks like, next week we'll have some pictures of it, but you'll look at it and you'll say, oh, that looks like the drive to Shoshone. It's just desolate, alkali, barren, miserable place where sheep have to be traveling all over the area just to get enough grass to munch on and survive. He started out as this great prince with great joy and great privilege. Ends up 80 years later as a shepherd of smelly sheep in a foreign land with a foreign wife, and his whole life derailed. Second thing that I learned is that even God's people suffer. Think about this. Moses' parents, Moses' family, Moses himself, they suffer. Life is not easy. I don't find in this text anywhere that special English word called Disneyland. It doesn't exist there because God hasn't promised us a Disneyland. There was a flash of faith with the brave midwives, with his mother who saved him. But we see suffering and oppression and groaning and travail. We're going to begin next Sunday, Lord willing, with the last couple verses of this chapter as it introduces the next part of Moses' life. But most of life, folks, is a downer, not an upper. Most of life is hard, even for God's people. But the third and last thing that we need to remember, God is in control. God is dealing with his hand, evident in every part of this chapter. It didn't just happen that his parents hid him. It didn't just happen that they put him in a basket. It didn't just happen that Pharaoh's daughter took him and then raised him as her own. It didn't just happen that Moses identified with his people in the midst of their bondage. It didn't just happen that he fled over to some well in the middle of Midian. It didn't just happen that for 40 years he grew and matured in the solitude and the communion of nature with nature's God. God's providence moves history in the direction that he wants it to go for his purpose and his promise. And the real issue to us is to learn this, to say, okay, these are cute little stories, all Moses in the basket floating on the river. Don't lose in the Sunday school story the real truth here. To endure the suffering, to have faith in God even when we can't see his hand working anywhere, when everything around us looks like failure, when we feel like Moses, just hoping somebody will open up the well to give him a drink, or years later when he has a baby and names him Stranger because he says, I'm a stranger, I don't belong here, I don't belong anywhere. And that we will see our standing, our salvation, our sanctification, our service, that's all a matter of God's grace and how he's going to use us. Because folks, Exodus chapter 2 is not the end of the story of Moses. It's just the beginning.